Hello and welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Andrew West. The federal budget is 2 weeks away and the head of one of Australia's biggest aid agencies is telling the government, please don't cut foreign aid. And we've the second part of our discussion on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail. The author of a new book on that fascinating letter discusses Dr. King's enduring distinction between just and unjust laws. But first, Sunday is election day in Malaysia. For the first time in 50 years, there's a chance the ruling party could lose. The ruling party is the United Malays National Organisation, or UMNO, headed by Prime Minister Najib Razak. The opposition coalition is led by the famous dissident, Dr. Anwar Ibrahim. Malaysia is a predominantly Muslim country. 60% of the people are followers, and religion is the white noise of politics there. To discuss the impact that religion is having on the poll, we've invited an old friend of the program, Clive Kessler, to join us. Clive is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of New South Wales and an international expert on Malaysia. Clive, I know you're about to get on a plane to go to Kuala Lumpur, so thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Clive, because this election is looking so close, is religion more of a factor in the sense that is it more of a wedge issue?
Religion is always a factor in Malaysian politics in its own right and also as a way for an idiom for the projection, less than explicitly, of Malay common interests. The election looks very close. It is deeply involved in this election, but not in the obvious way it was in the past. In the past, the main opposition to the governing coalition and its leading party, UMNO, was the Islamic Party that for 40 years was engaged in a policy auction with the UMNO, always upping the ante and challenging the UMNO to match it.
So dragging UMNO more towards its favoured, more purist vision of
indeed,
Islam?
Indeed. UMNO was always playing Islamist catch-up politics. Now, the Islamic Party is part of this popular front opposition coalition that Anwar Ibrahim has managed, perhaps improbably, to pull together. The Islamic Party is playing an Islamic politics, but a different kind of Islamist politics. It's one that is not universally agreed or supported within the Islamic Party itself. The Islamic Party is divided, but it's playing a more cautious kind of politics, looking to ride to power on the wave of something like the Arab Spring. And so the running on Islamist politics is now being made by the Prime Minister's UMNO party, not by the Islamist opposition.
Yes, just before we get on to UMNO, and that is the governing party, I want to flesh out this very important point that you raised about divisions within the Islamic party itself. I've been reading there's two wings to it. There's a wing that's developed to try to follow the Erdogan line in Turkey, calling itself the liberal wing. I mean, tell us a little more about that.
There is a young, moderate group within the Islamic Party leadership who see themselves as inclusive, democratic, universalist in aspiration. They are the part of the party that has made the running within the Islamic Party for this popular front coalition with the largely Chinese-supported Democratic Action Party and Anwar Ibrahim's Justice Party, which has mixed support. They believe in that and support it sincerely and genuinely with conviction and hope. But they are a minority within the party, and the dominant group within the party remains the old-style, hardline Islamist politicians who ultimately want an Islamic state, Sharia-minded men who want a Sharia-based state, and they are going along at the present with this strategy to see if it will bear fruit. They hold the view, as many, we might call them hardline Islamists in the Muslim world do today, they have failed to come to power by pushing the Islamic state line. They have seen how waves of democratization have opened up spaces of civil society. But the best placed people to take advantage of that new space and those opportunities have been, as with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the Islamists, and they look to the possibility, perhaps, of coming to power on this wave of democratization.
Well, this party does seem, at least on its public face, to have broadened so much that I read where the Islamist party has endorsed Christian candidates in some seats.
It does. It took them a while even to begin endorsing Muslim women candidates, but they got to that last time. They are putting up these candidates in certain electorates, not that they have great prospects of winning, but to show that they wish to reach beyond the boundaries of the Malay community and even beyond the boundaries of Islam. In other words, they wish to suggest that they are universalists, provided everybody can agree to their kind of Islamist universalism. Now, this gets to the central issue on which this whole election is turning. The election is boiling down to a showdown between two basic views of Malaysian society. On the one hand, the government, led by the UMNO, has taken a line which is largely dictated by the hardline Malay ethno-nationalist street heavies in many ways. And the government, following their line, and supported, of course, by the former Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, are running on the view, basically, if it can be caricatured, Malays on top, now and forever, this is Malaysia, love it or leave it. By contrast, the opposition is holding, managed under great difficulty to hold to a line which just says, of course, this country, historically and culturally, has been a Malay-centred society, but the nation and the state belong equally to all of its citizens.
Well, with the decision of the pan-Islamist Malaysia Party to kind of subdue that more hardline rhetoric, is this election therefore a little bit less religious in an overt sense?
I would say on the contrary, no. That in a strange way, the UMNO, the Prime Minister's party, is now running as the hardline Islamist party. That government has not been a very successful government, I would say, over the last 4 years in all sorts of other things, but it has been a very successful, stealth, slow, gradualist Islamizing party. And they are certainly making the running on a large number of Islamic issues.
Because they're important.
Ever since, of course, the Prime Minister went to Gaza in January to play the role of the International Islamic Action Man, they're certainly making very heavy running on such issues as the rights of Muslims and Muslims alone to use the word of Allah to refer to God, even though in the centuries before the birth of the Prophet Muhammad even, Christian Arabs in the Middle East used the word Allah to address reverentially their God. The Prime Minister is then pushing the Islamic issues very, very hard because his party is the out-front Islamist party in this campaign, whereas the Islamist party is holding back. And the reason he's doing this, the reason why Islam is such a potent issue in this election is that non-Malay support for the government has eroded very, very largely. The government's strategy for winning this election is to win as much as it can of the Malay vote. And if it wins 65% of the Malay vote in the right parts of the country, given the way the electoral malapportionment goes, they can win on that alone. And the way they have to do that is to break votes away from the Islamic party.
Just one last point, Clive. I've noticed in some of the reportage that PAS, the Pan-Islamic Malaysia Party, is fashioning itself, as many Islamist parties have done around the world, as the clean government party, the anti-corruption party. To what extent is this playing sort of in an authentic sense for them?
This does play for a number of reasons. Number one, the other side have been in power, and they've been giving out all the massive state contracts and patronage, which are a source of tremendous resentment. And anybody who has not been cut into the deals feels this is not only bad for them personally, but wrong in principle, and it is seen as being corrupt. The second thing is that the Islamic party, like Islamist parties everywhere else, pushes itself as the clean party, in many ways as the party of justice. And that notion of justice carries with it the notion of clean and upright government. In addition to that, it then comes down to the personal symbolics. You see all the grandees of the UMNO ruling party with their stretched limousines and whatever. The chief minister of the state of Kelantan, ruled by the Islamic party, an old-style religious teacher, lives very, very modestly, wanders around in his cotton sarong, lives a life of exemplary abstemiousness, modesty. And you just have to look at the symbolics of Tok Guru Nik Aziz and Prime Minister Najib, and you see it's modesty versus arrogance, it's clean government versus people who are steeped in the world of materialism and therefore are presumably tainted with corruption.
Well, that election is this coming Sunday in Malaysia. Professor Clive Kessler, Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of New South Wales, international expert on Malaysia. Thanks for fitting us in before you fly back to KL, Clive. We're very grateful.
My great pleasure, Andrew.
And on the Religion and Ethics Report, you're with me, Andrew West. The federal budget comes down on May 14. It's certain that money will be tight. Advocates for overseas development fear Australia's $5 billion aid budget will be an easy target. Australia has signed the International Millennium Goal of spending 0.7% of gross national income on aid. Australia currently gives half that amount. Tim Costello is CEO of World Vision Australia. He's lobbying for Australia to fulfil its millennium commitment, but he's also concerned about the desperate and often deadly conditions in which people in the poorest countries have to work. And there was a stark reminder of those conditions with the recent collapse of a clothing factory in Bangladesh. 400 people were killed. Tim Costello is speaking with John Cleary of ABC Local Radio.
When people are in the position of choosing between a job and their life, this is a false choice. This is a wrong, immoral choice. And as customers, we demand cheap clothing. Well, a Bangladeshi factory worker gets paid about $60 a month. In China, the next cheapest is about $120 a month. So they're already living on very, very little, so we get cheap goods. And now some 300 lives have been lost. So how we buy, how we put pressure on supply chains is our choice and our part in this.
Oxfam have pointed to our general responsibility. World Vision are saying, yes, that is part of our responsibility. It's not just a personal responsibility, though. Do governments have some role here?
Absolutely. Governments set the regulatory framework, and certainly there has been incentives in America around tariffs if there are, in Bangladesh and poor countries, safer working conditions. So governments can set the policy settings to say we're not going to allow this loss of life. We have a program at World Vision called Don't Trade Lives, which essentially focuses on trafficking and slavery. But the greatest amount of slavery in our world is labour slavery, not sex trafficking. And labour slavery is those people who are so desperately poor, they will work, as we have seen in Bangladesh, in terrible situations, just so they can feed their children.
Well, let's get on to this year's budget. It looms before us. We've already mentioned that there has been some stripping of the aid budget or redirection of it. It always appears in times of tightness as low-hanging fruit.
It does. Sadly, Richard Nixon got one thing right. There ain't no votes in aid, because aid benefits those outside Australia who can't vote. I would say that aid is the best government expenditure, bar none, in terms of its impact. Australian aid in the last year alone saved 200,000 lives. Worldwide aid saved 7 million lives. Lives of children. Australian aid in the last year was extraordinary in seeing kids get an education, something like 3 million kids. Now, when you stack that up against very real responsibilities in education and health here, you don't get a bigger bang for your buck than that.
But it's a bang not felt domestically.
It's a bang not understood domestically. World Vision's done a whole lot of vox pops, and we ask Australians how much they think is going on aid. And they will say, oh, minimum 5%, up to 10% of our GNI. And when you say, actually, it's not even 1%, it's 0.35%. I dramatise it saying, here's $100, that's our Australian national income. It's in 50-cent coins, 200 coins. How many do you think we actually give? People scoop up 10 coins, 20 coins. Oh, yeah, we must be giving $5, $10. I say we're not even giving one 50-cent coin and yet getting that life-saving bang for the buck. 42% drop in child infant deaths since 1990. By the way, in the poorest countries, people like to say, often on the conservative side, oh, it's really trade, not aid. It's India and it's Brazil that are lifting people out of poverty. It's trade. Actually, the greatest cuts in infant mortality have been 72% in Laos in the last 20 years, 71% in Liberia, Africa, in Cambodia, Rwanda. In the poorest countries that aren't trading, aid has saved lives. Australian aid has.
There's responsibilities here for both government and opposition because you play into a political context and the context is set by the debate. We're moving away from the addiction to the surplus. That seems both parties have given up on that. But we're still in a situation where the deficit looms. And in the prospect of a deficit, it's interesting to see the way the rhetoric has played out in Australia when you compare it to, say, Britain, which is facing even greater economic problems. Yet they've managed to hang on to their commitment to overseas aid. What's happened?
I certainly say this to coalition politicians, David Cameron. Not only has lifted aid in the UK to 0.5, but he's legislated to go to 0.7, the international promise.
And where are we at the moment?
0.35. And talks of more being misdirected or redirected to ourselves, making ourselves the third largest recipient of our own aid after Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. I also say to conservative politicians, aid was at its highest under Bob Menzies. Aid actually was cut most dramatically under Bob Hawke. Aid isn't a left-right issue. It should be above politics because it saves lives. And if we keep our promise of just going to 0.5, Brits are already there. By the way, the Scandinavians and the Norwegians are at 1%. We're way behind. We're 13th out of 24 countries in the OECD. If we just keep our promise of going to 0.5, it will be nearly a million lives over the next 4 years that Australia's aid saves. So I don't want to sound too dramatic, but it is a matter of life and death. And the ignorance that people in Australia have that we are already massively generous is our main problem. And politicians can skate around with promises to an electorate that's actually hurting in parts, but largely well off. On the Human Development Index, health, we're second only to Norway in the whole world. On the wealth index, we are second only to Switzerland in the whole world, per capita wealth. So we're wealthy, we're healthy, we're not very wise when we think we're so generous.
In brief then, what are you looking for out of the coming budget?
We're looking for it to go from 0.35 to 0.37, which is about another extra $500 million. Our promise to the world is 0.7. But both sides have made promises to the electorate. 0.5 is achievable. And if they walk away from that using a surplus or deficit as the reason to really impact on lives, then that's wrong.
Do you expect the rhetoric to go something like, we're not actually cutting, but we are slowing the rate of increase?
Yeah, that'll be the rhetoric. There's all sorts of ways to confound and confuse us. And I would just add that most Australians pride themselves actually on the impact we make. We live in the region where most of the world's poor live, and it so happens that region has really helped our economy. It's been Asia buying our minerals. So it's smart investment in our region to actually show concern. But the rhetoric will have some spin in it, and it really plays to Nixon's adage, there's no votes in AIDS.
Reverend Tim Costello, CEO of World Vision, thanks for joining us on the Religion Report.
A pleasure.
And you can hear a longer version of that interview with Tim Costello on Sunday night with John Cleary on your local ABC station at 10 p.m. Finally, let's resume our discussion about Martin Luther King's famous letter from Birmingham jail. It was written 50 years ago. Jonathan Ryder is the author of a new book, Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King's Letter from Birmingham Jail and the Struggle That Changed a Nation. Last week, he discussed why Dr. King had written his letter. He was in jail for trying to organise a boycott of segregated stores in Birmingham, Alabama, and eight self-described moderate religious leaders had requested he tone down his nonviolent protests. In the final part of our interview, Jonathan Ryder discusses the changing tone of Dr. King's letter, which began very diplomatically, and he also discusses the enduring messages that it contains about human rights.
Well, it's so interesting because with King, these things are never, 100% separated, but there is the refined a clergyman deep in intellect who's reaching out and for that first half as diplomat trying to make whites understand what it is like to be a black man in America and why the urgency, the fierce urgency of now is justified. And so in many different ways he wins them over. And I'll just mention a couple. He starts out as the mannerly king. We know that he's furious. He is burning up, and we know this from mass meetings right after he gets out of jail. But how does he start out? He says, "My dear fellow clergymen," it's the most genteel, almost precious overture to them, and he refers to my Jewish and Christian brothers and sisters. At other moments, he tries to explain rationally, "We're not extremists. We tried negotiations. Our protests are only to try to get people who refuse to negotiate. Don't you see? We agree with you. Of course negotiation is better." Then he tries pathos, and he has a long 300-word sentence in which he tries to make them feel what it's like to be a black person. "When you see your brothers and sisters murdered and lynched, when you have to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the segregated fun town, when you feel a profound sense of nobodiness," to get them on his side almost every way he can. And that goes on right to that transformative midpoint, which is really quite dramatic, and then he's abandoned that effort for the most part.
Well, yes, when he talks and rejects the argument that he's an extremist, he posits himself very much in the center of this debate, because I think he also says, if you want to see extremism, look at the rising anger of black nationalist movements, look at the Nation of Islam, headed by the Reverend Elijah Muhammad.
He's still at that moment trying to persuade them. It's as if he's saying, "Oh, you think I'm an extremist? No, no, let me try to convince you I'm not." Right? So he says, on the one side are those black nationalists, some of whom are verging on hate and violence, and on the other side are those blacks who are so adjusted to segregation, they can't even stand up for themselves. And so by that kind of positioning, King has placed himself right in the middle. And so in a sense, he's saying at that moment, "Don't you see, I'm a moderate like you are." He's recasting himself as a moderate. And he goes on in that vein until suddenly he does an exact about face. And this whole document is full of these swerves, of these shifts, these dramatic changes. And at that moment, King says, after trying to persuade them he's not an extremist, "After thinking about it, I began to take pleasure in realizing I am an extremist. Jesus was an extremist for love and justice. Amos was an extremist. Let justice roll down like waters." And typical of King, he's using the words of these religious authorities to smack back at his opponents, as if, how can you dispute the words of the Old and New Testament, which presumably we all accept as arbiters of moral authority.
What does King say about just and unjust laws? Because that's such an important and enduring distinction.
He's still in that early phase of the diplomat trying to convince them. And now he's meeting them on common ground as religious people who share theological roots together. He sounds like the professor almost. "Now, what is the difference between a just and an unjust law?" And he quotes St. Augustine, "An unjust law is one that is not rooted in the moral law." So he's trying to get them to see that violating laws are not all the same. To violate the law, as while George Wallace and the segregationists do, is not the same thing as violating an unjust law that is not rooted in natural law or God's law. And he does the same thing. He says, Paul Tillich has said, sin is separation. So what is more separating than segregation laws that say blacks and whites are not even in the same category of humanity? Therefore, all segregation statutes are unjust, and it's okay to violate them. So that theological debate is alive as he parses the difference between the just and the unjust law.
And what does he say about this other interesting philosophical point, distinguishing between negative peace and positive peace? Because again, that is a message that is enduring beyond the civil rights movement.
It is so enduring because it goes back to the issue of law and order. Because here is when King turns into the prophet, he's criticizing both white moderates and then the white church. And what's wrong with the white moderate? They prefer the negative peace of stability to the positive good of justice. And what he's trying to say is many of us recoil from agitation, disruption, but That disruption is what is required to go beyond injustice, to get to a just peace. So what you want is the lack of tension that shows the presence of justice, not its absence. So it's his way of saying, I'm not afraid of the word tension. You don't like protests at all, but that's what we need to get from a negative peace to the positive presence of justice. And it's just a transition on the way to an ethically just society.
Surely the most confronting line in this whole essay, I mean, you're an expert, you've read it a lot more deeply than most of us, but it struck me that the most confronting line was basically where he said that white moderates, and we're talking here about people who thought quite well of themselves, they thought they were well motivated, he argues that they were a greater stumbling block to civil rights than the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council, which was widely known as the sort of gentleman's Klan.
Well, what he's saying there in such a powerful way is it makes all those decent white Americans who think of themselves as believers in democracy but never even think of the contradiction between their belief in democracy and American exceptionalism and we're a redeemer nation and the fact that a whole class of people do not have access to democracy in America. And so for King, the violent KKK, that's what you expected from them. But it's these good, well-meaning Americans, and he's talking about the majority of Americans, the core of American culture, who cannot see that their acquiescence is what sustains the Klan and the violent cadres. And so that is central, because he's saying, don't think because you do not like crosses and do not attack blacks and maybe don't even use racist language, that you somehow are exempt from moral responsibility. And it's why I describe what King is doing in the letter, but more generally, as the existential version of deliverance. And what he's saying is, for the oppressed, black people, you have a responsibility to free yourself and deliver yourself. Do not wait for God to do it. God wants you to free yourself. And white people, you may be decent, you think you're not racist, but your silence is complicity in maintaining a racist order, so you have a moral responsibility as well by your own inaction. And you must act and speak up and speak loudly. And therefore, in King's larger vision, it's an ethical vision of moral responsibility that both blacks and whites have. The gospel of freedom is a very demanding one. And at one point when King is preaching, and he describes how Moses goes to God and says, you know, the children of Israel are murmuring and complaining. You know, they're waiting for you to take them to the promised land. And God says, why do you come speak to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. And King was basically saying, and this really takes us up to modern life, that we all have an obligation to do something in the face of our suffering colleagues around the globe, whether they're of our tribe or some other tribe.
That's Jonathan Ryder, author of Gospel of Freedom, a book about the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. And that ends this week's edition of the Religion and Ethics Report. If you missed the first part of that interview last week, go to our homepage at the RN website, where you can find it under the week of April 24. And you can find all of today's stories at our homepage, where you can download or podcast them. That's the program for this week. Thanks to producer Noel Debien and technical producer Paul Gough. And next, it's breakfast.